Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the Keddie Cabin murders of 1981. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon for as little as $1.99 a month. You can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie, Betty, Matt, Kenny, and John. They all went to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. And until the end of December, if you go there, you can get up to 1 month free from the Deathcaster tier, or 2 months free from the support tier. Both tiers will get you access to early ad-free shows as well as to the exclusive content. Again, that's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, or just click the link in the episode notes. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last time. We were talking about all of the various players inside the saga that is the Keddie Cabin murders that took place on April 11th and 12th, 1981 in Keddie, California. This week, we are going to look at the crime itself as well as the initial police investigation. And I want to warn you that there's some pretty graphic content that we're going to be discussing almost right off the bat. As we're going to be looking at the actual discovery of the bodies. Now, on April 12th, at roughly 10 a.m., Sheila Sharp, you'll remember she's the older daughter who had been sent up to Oregon to give birth to a child who her mother Sue had then made her put up for adoption, returned from spending the night at the Siebold family's cabin. Now, the Siebold family had a number of children around Sue Sharp's children's age, and according to statements that were given to police as well as in later interviews, Sheila was offered to go to church with the family. She agreed to this, said she wanted to stop home first, let her mother know, and brought her things back with her to the cabin. And as soon as she opens the front door to the cabin, she sees three dead bodies in the living room. She drops her stuff and runs back to the Siebold's house, screaming hysterically that there are three dead people in the cabin. Sheila would later tell investigators that she had seen a knife, which she mistook for a pocket knife, lying in the cabin. It would later be discovered that this was in fact a steak knife that was bent and had been used in the murders. Now, the matriarch of the Siebold family, Zanita Siebold, ran across the street to cabin 25, where the landlords for all of the cabins resided, and there she was able to contact the police. The oldest of the Siebold children, Jamie Siebold, returns to the cabin with Sheila, asking her questions as they go. And Sheila states that she only saw the three victims in the living room. For some reason, Jamie decides to check the side of the house where one of the bedrooms is located at. He knocks on the window and is startled to see a face appear. Jamie quickly gets the individuals inside of that bedroom, Greg and Rick Sharp, as well as their friend Justin Essen, also known in some documents as Justin Smart, the biological son of Marilyn Smart and the stepson of Martin Smart. Justin had spent the night with the Sharp family. Later, all of the boys are going to claim to have seen and heard nothing. Jamie ends up going up the back stairs of the house to the door, not wanting to contaminate the living room where the bodies are known to be located, hoping to find another survivor. According to statements he later gave authorities, the back door to the house was in fact left ajar. However, after taking a brief glance around, he quickly leaves, having spied no one still moving. When Plumas County Sheriff's officials arrive up in the Keddie Resort, they very quickly corridor off the crime scene and begin assessing the situation. There are three individuals in the living room lying dead. Sue Sharp, her son Johnny, and Dana Wingate. It's a pretty horrific crime scene. It's found that all of the victims had had their feet and hands bound with medical tape. Sue also had a pair of underwear, later determined to be hers, shoved into her mouth. All the victims bear the markings of having been stabbed or bludgeoned with a claw hammer, and it's later determined that Dana Wingate had in fact been manually strangled to death. There is blood all over the cabin into the kitchen, and police cannot understand how no one inside of the house could have heard any of this. The three boys state rather emphatically that they neither saw nor heard anything during the night, further leading to confusion. Officers have very few clues to go on as far as who could have done this or why, and it very quickly comes out that the other daughter of Susan Sharp, Tina, who's 12 years old, is in fact missing. And police are going to waste a little bit of time trying to track Tina down, as it's thought by some that she may have gone to spend the evening at a friend's house. Police start to canvass the neighborhood, as well as to question Sheila Sharp for any pertinent information that she might be able to give. And we're going to go over the timeline of events as stated by Sheila Sharp for the date of April 11th. Around noon, she states Sue dropped her off in the parking lot to the mall, that Dana Wingate was hitchhiking to Keddie Resort. Some point not long after this, Sue, with Ricky in tow, picks Sheila up from the mall. Three of them then head over to Ganser Park and pick up Johnny and Dana before heading back to Keddie Resort. Between 5 and 6 p.m., Johnny and Dana, who are at the foster home where Dana Wingate is staying in Quincy, call the Sharp family residence. At some point after this, Sheila and Tina go over to the Seabolt home, and around 8:15, Sheila goes back to her house to get some clothing as she is going to spend the night, at which point her mother informs her that both her brother and Dana had gone back to town. Sheila says that her mother was lying on the couch while the three boys, Ricky, Greg, and Justin, were also in the room. All of them were watching television. Tina ends up going back to the house around 9:30. We also have a number of other statements that authorities got in the days following the murders, and these are from various individuals. Whether or not these statements are in fact true cannot be verified, but they do bear out the fact that Dana and Johnny Sharp are hitchhiking. Numerous people see both boys over by the Exxon in Quincy, and a number of them stop over. They also learn that earlier in the day, Dana and Johnny had gone over to the home of an older adult male. Some people had seen them at this house, after which they went over to the foster home that Dana was staying at. The boys inside of the Sharp home, those who survived, give an account of watching television and playing outside. Ricky also informed police somewhere between 8:30 and 9:30 that his brother Johnny had called the house to inform his mother that he will be returning later that evening with Dana. We know that somewhere between 9:30 and 9:45, both boys end up getting picked up and they drive to the park but are unable to find any parties. At which point he drops the two boys off at the van gas station. A number of different sources give conflicting accounts as to who picked up both Dana and Johnny. One woman who had given statements immediately after the murders would state in 1985 that it was in fact she who had picked up the boys and had driven them to the Keddy Camp Road around 10 p.m. However, stories that the police heard during the immediate investigation were that an unknown male or males had picked both boys up and driven them up to the cabin. However, this ends up being conflicted by individuals who state that they saw both Johnny and Dana walking up the road into Keddy. A police officer takes a statement wherein he is told that the rumor going around town at this point is that Dana and Johnny had gotten into a fight with two Native American men who had said that if they did not get what they wanted from Johnny Sharp, they would kill both Johnny and his family. Back at the cabin, according to Justin, Tina ends up going to bed at around 9:45. She states she was wearing a blue shirt, blue pants, and tennis shoes at this point. Police also start getting a lot of information concerning supposed parties happening that night in and around Keddy, where they suspect the killer or killers may have been at before going up to the Sharp home and committing the murders. Both Paula and Pearl Siebold state that they saw a green van parked outside of the Sharp residence somewhere around 9 o'clock. Marilyn Sharp is also questioned by the police during this initial phase of the investigation, and she states that her husband had repeatedly been telling her for the last few days that he was going to have to fix his friend Bo up with a woman. Now, according to Marilyn, she told authorities, quote, "Sue is alone and all the kids are probably in bed and she'd probably like to go out to the bar with them." We do know that Ricky Sharp stated to the police that at somewhere during this point in time between 9 and 10, A phone call comes into the house. Sue answers it, asks who it is. However, it does not appear that the conversation lasted very long or that he remembers anything else of interest from that phone call. We get a very interesting statement from a woman by the name of Donna who said around 10:30 she had picked both Dana and Johnny up and driven them up into Keddy, and that she had seen Sue Sharp when she dropped the boys off, and that it appeared to her that Sue was dressed up as though she was going to go out. Now, this conflicts with what we know, as Sue was found wearing a bathrobe and t-shirt along with her glasses. According to Marilyn Sharp, at around 10 p.m., she, her husband, and Beau all go to the backdoor bar in Keddy. And we do have witnesses that put both of the men in the bar with Marilyn. Both Beau and Martin are described as having been dressed very loudly with these really gaudy, god-awful suits. While there, according to statements Marty gave to the police, he saw two hippie types that left the bar at some point in a pickup truck. Another patron said that she had seen an older-looking station wagon parked nose into the bar when she arrived, and that it was still there when she later left. Marty also tells the police that he had heard rumors around town that the Quincy area had just received a large shipment of acid and marijuana, and that there was supposedly a party going on in town. There's also a lot of rumors spinning around and getting back to the police that both Dana and Johnny Sharp had been seen at numerous parties the night of the 11th. However, the timeline that ends up emerging is that the boys really didn't seem to have gotten into much of anything while they were in Quincy and appear to have been back in Keddy somewhere between 10 and 11, which negates a lot of these stories that are being told to police, as these parties and witnesses who say they saw both boys seem to have taken place well after the period in time when it's believed that the boys arrived back at the cabin. Now, one man states that he had seen a dark-colored car with San Rafael license plates along with a tan-colored car. And supposedly, someone was selling drugs out of this tan car. This individual further tells police that he saw the dark-colored car with the San Rafael license plate on his way back to Keddy. It was pulled over to the side of the road with a flat tire, and the tan car was not far from it. This same man is going to give conflicting statements regarding these two cars. In one statement, he says that he saw them on his way to Keddy. Another statement, he says that he saw them as he was leaving Keddy and that he believed he had seen both vehicles a week prior. He further goes on to tell police that he saw a dark-colored car parked in front of the Sharp residence between 11 and 11:30, while another car drove up deeper into the Keddy Resort before disappearing, and that when he left, the dark-colored car was still in front of the Sharp residence. Sheila Sharp stated that she went to bed around 11 p.m., while another woman who came forward said that she had driven past the Sharp residence at about 10 after 11 and recalled seeing a light on inside. Now, a few different witnesses told authorities that Around 11:30 at night, they noticed that the lights were off at the Sharp residence. One person said that although they didn't see anything unusual outside the Sharp residence, they did note that a truck was parked outside of the residence around 11:30. So police start getting a lot of different tips, most of them involving unidentified subjects, some stating that these individuals looked wild and unkempt, others that they were railroad workers who were thought to be involved in drugs and or violent crimes. However, none of these leads seem to be panning out. Then they learn from the proprietor of the backdoor bar that Bo, Marilyn, and Marty had left the bar that evening after becoming upset when the bar decided to switch the music on the jukebox. Marilyn Smart would state that this was somewhere around 1 a.m. that they walked home. And it's interesting to note that when she initially tells this story, she says that it's Marty who's angry over the music, but then it's Bo who, at their cabin, continues to fume about the music when Marty suggests that they return, stating that he is so angry that he could quote-unquote kill someone. If we assume, even for the briefest of instances, that the music being changed in the bar was that big of an issue, the thought that either one of these men is angry enough to consider a homicide over it sounds to me like a line of shit that they were giving to the officers for some unknown reason. We do know that Marty and Bo do return to the bar at around 1:15. Both men told officers that they didn't see anything when they were walking past the Sharp residence. However, other witnesses stated that they saw no lights on when they drove past cabin 28, something that was unusual as the front light was almost always on. Now, according to the residents of cabin 16, somewhere between 1:15 and 1:30, they were awoken by what sounded to them to be muffled screams coming from somewhere beyond the rear of their cabin in the direction of cabin 28. However, neither of these individuals went to investigate it further. Another individual in a different cabin stated that on that night it was unusually quiet with not a lot of traffic through the resort, and that his cat seemed off all evening, constantly wanting to go in and out, which he found odd as they normally slept through the night. He described to officers getting up 5 or 6 times between 1 and 1:30 a.m. to let the cats either out of the cabin or back in. We have statements from both Bo and the bartender at the bar, Kathy, that at some point after Bo and Marty returned to the bar, Marty left for a few minutes, not saying anything to anyone, before eventually returning. We know that both men were only there a short period of time, and then they left, ostensibly to return to the cabin. Marty did later tell authorities that Bo was asleep on the couch at some point during the night when he got up to go put more wood on the fire. The bartender at the backdoor bar told authorities that somewhere around 2:20 a.m. she closed the bar, and as she made her way to her car, she heard what sounded like a man and a woman fighting as they placed something inside of a car trunk. Although she was unable to tell where this actually came from. At 4 a.m., the resident in cabin, B gets up and sees that the back porch light on the Sharp residence is, in fact, on. Something that, again, was extremely rare. As if we didn't have conflicting reports enough as is, the timeline of when Sheila Sharp is supposed to have gone home, in police reports at least, magically jumps from 10 until 8 a.m. with the rescue of the boys being placed somewhere around 8:30, and this can almost certainly be attributed to the fact that Sheila was interviewed again in the mid to late 80s, and by that point, although the events may have been seared into her mind, the actual time that these things took place may, in fact, have shifted for her. This is not an uncommon occurrence in these types of murder investigations where a person will misremember a time. Now, on to Marty and Beau. The two of them, along with Marilyn Smart, are going to end up being interviewed by investigators. And we know that both Beau and Marty appear to have incriminated themselves in the crime. This comes from the fact that during the days after the murders, Justin Smart begins to tell his mother that he had dreams wherein he saw two men arguing with Johnny Sharp and Dana, and that Sue was tied up on the couch. Now, police are eventually going to bring Justin in and have him hypnotized, but when asked about Justin by the police, Marty states, quote, "He is quiet enough to where he could have noticed something without me detecting him." Martin also states that he'd like to see the hammer that police found at the crime scene, as the only hammer he had ever seen in Sue's house had a wooden handle, before telling the police that a hammer he had that was out on the front porch had recently gone missing, although he could not give them an exact time period for when this missing hammer had been discovered. Martin implicates himself further while talking about how Marilyn had seen Justin outside reenacting the murders with his brother. Martin states that he had been in Reno that day, that would have been the 17th, and that Marilyn told him about it when he returned home. Marty says to police, quote, yes, he has. He tried to recreate it with his little brother yesterday over there, and the wife watched him go through it, and he's telling Casey, you know, to hold his arm like he had a knife trying to stab it. But from what I understand, the people were killed with a hammer. After that, they were stabbed. So I get the feeling that he was just, you know, play-acting his little creation. It seems unusual that he knew so much about the condition of inside of the house, and he was supposed to have been asleep, you know? Martin is then asked whether or not there was a possibility Justin could have seen inside the house after authorities arrive, and Marty insists that the security was too tight for that to have happened, and that he did not allow Justin to leave the property the rest of the day. When asked later why he doesn't believe the children in the back bedroom were killed, Marty says, quote, "It's overkill, you know. For one, this is, if it was, I know if I was going to kill somebody, I'd go in, blam, 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 and get going. I mean, there's no sense in going any further than that. You go in and you do what has to be done. Make sure the job is done right and get going. There would be no sense in beating them or mutilating them or anything like that. The person that would go for that, why didn't he hurt those other kids?" Officers then asked Marty why he thought Tina was taken, to which he says, "I was thinking, okay, I know this girl is the father's favorite kid, who I've never met. This is what I've heard from a few conversations, that he is supposed to have been in Connecticut. So they said, well, maybe the father, maybe the boys tried to stop him, so he had to take them out too, because, or maybe the boys walked in on something, and he took them out because of that. Before they realized who it was, we entertained the thought that maybe it was Dana that did it, because he is supposed to be mentally disturbed. Both of those boys were experimenting with drugs. This is a known fact." Marty continues to ramble on, dancing around certain topics. The officers really don't come back to anything concerning his statements, his slip-ups about, you know, Justin having seen, quote-unquote, him. They also interviewed Beau somewhere around the 13th or 14th. This was done in the banquet room of the main building at the Keddie Resort. The reason that they decided to interview Beau was because they had learned through sources unknown that Beau was planning on leaving the area on that date. One thing of interest from Beau's interview is that he claims not to know which house the murders had taken place in. When the police press him on this, asking whether or not he has seen a lot of cop cars in the area, he responds that yes, there have been, and there was an area that was taped off with police tape. They were coming and going, but he didn't realize that this was the house where the murders had took place, something that is extremely unlikely. Beau tells officers that he is a very light sleeper, and if there had been any sort of noise, he almost certainly would have woken up. This is going to conflict with the interview that the police give to Marty, where Marty says that because of the medication that Beau was on, all heavy tranquilizers, once Beau took it, he was down for the count for the night. Also claims that Marilyn was still up when they returned to the house, stating that Marilyn is in fact his niece, that Beau's sister is Marilyn's mother. Beau then tells the officers if they need to get in contact with him, they can get his address from Maryland, as he's going up to Klamath Falls, Oregon, to work on a police newspaper selling advertisements. The officers then bring up the lie Beau has told, wherein he was a retired police officer, claiming that he worked as an officer in Cook County, Illinois, for the Sheriff's Department for 18 years before retiring to a medical disability after he was shot. Tells the police that he retired in 1958 and that as a result of the shooting, he is completely impotent. Although he still has the desires, he cannot act upon them. This actually plays into what I believe happened in the house, and we're going to talk about that later. Back to Beau's interview. Beau continues spinning yarns about having opened different businesses and worked various newspapers, selling advertising for policemen's magazines, doing everything that he can to make certain that they don't learn that he is a convicted felon. They do catch Beau in a lie when they're asking him why he has the ID card for a police officer that Beau says worked for him. Beau claims that he took the man's ID when the man was fired. He then is asked whether or not Justin has made any statements concerning the murders, and Beau states that he did not, but on the morning of the murders, after they got Justin home, he was telling his brother, quote unquote, I'll kill you, that's just how it was done. When asked if they believe that Justin had seen anything, Beau goes on and says that he thinks the kid probably did, but he shut the memories off. Beau also tells the officers that, you know, he and Marty have talked about it, as have he, Marty, and Marilyn, and they've wondered whether or not the ex-husband may have done it. He also says that Marilyn was under the impression, before they knew who all had died, that Dana had actually committed the murders. Although once they learned that he was one of the victims, they changed their mind on this scenario. The officers then press Bo for more information about what he's planning on doing after he leaves the area. He claims that he's going to be going up to Oregon, and that Marty's going to be joining him, and that he had known Marty prior to Marty and Marilyn hooking up, and that the two of them had come back to Getty together, not so he could visit his niece, but because Bo wanted to start up doing a map of the Getty area for reasons that are known only to he and Marty. However, Bo states that trying to do such a thing is just too difficult. But he does let the officers know that he and Marty are planning on returning to the area after they do this business up in Oregon. At one point, Bo tells the officers something along the lines, although it's fairly unintelligible on the transcript as well as the actual sound recording, that he'll call the sheriff's office before they find us. One very important thing from this interview is the fact that the officers keep returning to things that Bo has already talked about. Usually when this happens during a police interview, it's because the police know something that they haven't yet shared with an individual, and they're trying to trip them up, get them to reveal something. And this is almost certainly because at this point, even though they don't have a whole lot of information to go on, they're looking at Bo and Marty as possible suspects. If not Marty entirely, then certainly Bo. The police turn the tape off and on over the next few minutes as Bo basically gives them no information. Eventually, Marty shows up and they get both Marty and Bo on tape, at which point they terminate the interview. Bo had been with them for over an hour. After this interview, officers interview Marty. We know that Bo leaves the area, and right around the time Bo leaves, Marty also leaves the area, heading back to the VA hospital in Reno, Nevada. And a number of things are going to come from this particular stay at the VA hospital. However, some sources state that he did in fact go up to Oregon with Bo. These cannot be completely confirmed. We do know that somewhere in between Oregon and Reno, Marty sent Marilyn a note demanding that she come back to him. And this letter contains an extremely damning line, which many believe is a full-on confession from Marty. Quote, "I've paid the price of your love, and now that I've bought it with four people's lives, you tell me that we're through. Great, what else do you want?" Marilyn said that she gave this letter to authorities at some point well after the murders. However, we really have no idea knowing when, in fact, she gave this letter to them. We do know that Marilyn claimed to have moved out of the cabin the day after the murders, although reasons as to why differ. Some state it's because of her involvement in these murders, others that she was getting away from Marty and his abuse. Well, the third thread has it that Marilyn was sleeping around on Marty as much as he was sleeping around on her and that she left because of this. In any event, Marilyn and her children do end up leaving the area. The children of Sue Sharp end up going to live with relatives of hers where they will be raised. But the case doesn't end there. Police are still investigating it, trying to figure out what the hell happened to Tina. Who could have done this thing? Current investigators now allege that a cover-up took place between the perpetrators Marty and Beau and the then Plumas County Sheriff, who lived in Cabin 28 prior to Sue moving in. There is some evidence to suggest that this is in fact the case, as Marty's counselor at the VA hospital in Reno came out in recent years saying that Marty had confessed to having committed the murders to him. However, he says that Marty only admitted to having killed Sue and Tina, that he had nothing to do with the boys. That Marty was deadpan when he told him this, completely emotionless. That he had incapacitated Tina, thus keeping her from running away. And that he had killed Tina because she saw the entire thing and he couldn't have a witness. This counselor says that he told Marty to turn himself into the police and also contacted the police himself. However, no record of any such phone call exists. It's more than that, though, with these two particular suspects that are highly suspicious. Both men stated that Marty made a phone call from the cabin number 26, after they left the bar the first time. Police do not appear to have pulled phone records to verify this part of the story, which you would think they would want to do if A, they were interested in solving this crime, or B, they suspected one or both men of having committed this murder. There's other things that don't add up with any of this as well. Supposedly, Justin described seeing two men, which he gave composite sketches of, inside of the cabin. This was when he was hypnotized, and that both men were wearing jeans and jean jackets. Again, he stated in an interview many years later that he saw Marty burning clothing in the fireplace to the cabin. This would have had to have been within a very, very short period of time after the murders. One also has to wonder, too, if Justin did see something, why has he not now come forward and admitted to the police what it was exactly that he saw? Some have speculated that the reason for this could be the fact that he had not only seen Marty and Beau, but also possibly his mother or a member of law enforcement inside of the cabin assaulting Sue and then her son and Dana. What about Tina? We do know from police records that knife marks were discovered on the walls of the cabin, which, if true, means that somebody went after someone else in the house with one of these knives, or that the fight, which is believed to have broken out between one of the suspects and one or two of the victims, ended up with the killer stabbing the wall as he sought to neutralize one of the victims. What of Tina Sharp? What ends up becoming of her? Unfortunately, remains end up being discovered in 1984 in Camp 18, which is in Butte County, California, about 5 or so miles from Feather Falls, California. The way that these remains were discovered was extremely strange. A man claiming to be a bottle collector was out in this extremely remote area when he says he came upon a human skull. He contacted the police, who go out there and discover the remains, which eventually are discovered to have been Tina Sharp's. Now, the problem with this story is that Camp 18 is in the middle of nowhere, and the area where Tina's body was discovered on the side of an embankment was in the middle of nowhere's middle. I mean, it was that far out there that there was very little chance of anyone having been back there for years. Yet this can collector, on April 11th, 1984, 3 years to the day of the murders, this man is out there and he stumbles upon these remains. Police don't seem to have asked any real questions of the man. And not long after news of remains having been found, but before they were identified in June, the police in Plumas County get a call from an unidentified man who identifies the remains as belonging to Tina Sharp. This was not recorded, meaning it was not written down in the evidentiary file. Instead, the tape was tossed into a box and forgotten about until some point after 2013, when a deputy who had been assigned this cold case discovered it in the bottom of a box. Authorities really didn't do much follow-up on any of their, you know, potential suspects. We know that Bo ends up dying in, I believe, 1988, with police never having questioned him further. Martin Ray Smart ends up dying in 2000, May 26th, specifically at the age of 51 in Portland, Oregon. Again, with no apparent follow-up by sheriff's officials into his possible involvement in these murders. Now, the Plumas County Sheriff's Office did reopen the case in 2016, and eventually another knife and a hammer, believed to have been the hammer that went missing from Marty's cabin, are located. This hammer was located inside of a dried up pond down the road from where the cabins stood. Police have also said that they do have DNA evidence from a still living person of interest. However, since these revelations, nothing further has come from this case. Although there are a lot of theories about what actually went down, some of them quite offensive, particularly the ones that point to Sheila Sharp, the 14-year-old daughter of Sue, as having been the instigator of these murders, as well as members of the Meeks family and other men that Sue Sharp had been involved with. These stories generally center around a conspiracy widely known throughout town and covered up for decades, wherein Bo and Marty were sent up to kill Sue and anyone who happened to be with her at that point in time. I think it's absolute bullshit to think that a 14-year-old girl would conscript her mother and siblings to murder because the mother put her daughter's child up for adoption. And while I think this case may eventually be closed in that law enforcement is going to state that, you know, these are the people who have done it, but because they are no longer with us, we cannot bring charges. However, if they were still alive, we would bring charges. I do have a theory as to why all of this happened. And I'm going to share it with you at this point. I don't believe that Sue was having an affair with Marty. I think Marty may have said things in front of Marilyn that may have led her to believe this. More likely than not, it was Marty, you know, making comments about Sue's looks, how he found her attractive, etc., etc. I think that because of this and because of other infidelities from Marty, he and Marilyn's marriage began to disintegrate. He was often violent with her, both physically and psychologically, which led to numerous breakups between the two of them. I think the sheriff's department during that period of time, specifically the sheriff for Plumas County, was as dirty as the day is long, and that if he was not involved in drug dealing, he was getting a kickback from those who were doing the drug dealing. This man went on the record stating that he and Marty were great friends, and that Marty would often ride around with him in his car while he was out on patrol. It's almost a certainty that this man knew Marty was selling drugs and very possibly knew about all of his infidelities, and that he was possibly getting a kickback from Marty in order to leave Marty be to do the things that he was doing. I also believe that Sue Sharp, who had gone through an abusive relationship with her own husband, was in fact trying to convince Marilyn Smart to leave Marty, and that on the night of April 11th, everything culminated in a psychotic episode, for want of a better term. I believe that Marty was in fact trying to hook Bo up with a local woman, and that he settled on Sue Sharp, and that on the night of April 11th, he called Sue to see if she would be interested in going out with them to the bar. Remember, Sue is said to have asked, "Who is this?" when someone called on the phone, and we never found out who it was. I think that was either Marilyn or Marty. I think that Sue may initially have agreed to go down with them before deciding that she did not want to go. Again, the police never made phone record searches, so we don't know if there were calls to and from the Sharp household to the Smarts, but I think that's probably more likely than not the case, that they went down to the bar. And the longer they were there, the more both Bo and Marty thought about Sue turning them down, that they got pissed off, used the change in music at the bar as an excuse to go back to the house, knowing that Marilyn was not going to go back out with them again. At which point, Marty called the bar to apologize over his concocted outrage, and then told Marilyn that both of them were going back to the bar so that Marty could apologize for the two of them. The fact that there were so few people in the bar, and obviously no one that Bo would be interested in hooking up with, further fueled their anger. I think they stuck their head in the bar for a few minutes just to get an alibi, and then quietly slipped out and headed up to the Sharp house between 1 and 1:15. I believe that they went up there with the intention of Bo raping Sue Sharp. I think that is the reason that her underwear was removed, and also the reason why Bo told authorities that he was impotent, he couldn't get it up, in case they found traces of semen on Sue's body. I think they overpowered her, and Bo was in the act of taking what he wanted from Sue when Dana and Johnny Sharp, who were downstairs in the basement, came bursting in from the back door, having heard the sounds of a struggle down below. That while Bo stood there or continued to act upon Sue, Marty got into it with Johnny Sharp, whom many have said he had a problem with, and they got into a physical altercation that resulted in Marty stabbing or attempting to stab Johnny, and Bo leaving Sue for a moment to go and aid his friend, striking Johnny with a hammer, getting him onto the ground, where Marty is then able to tie Johnny's hands and feet, while Bo goes and subdues Dana Wingate, tying his hands and feet as well. I think it's at this point that Justin comes out, sees what his stepfather and his stepfather's friend are involved in, and Marty says something to the effect of, "Go the fuck back to bed, you didn't see anything." At which point Justin disappears, and Sue Sharp attempts to flee from the cabin with her hands bound. Marty grabs Sue, drags her back to the couch, throws her down, and then ties her feet. She still has the underwear lodged in her mouth, as it had been shoved so far back in that it nearly cut off her ability to breathe. And at this point, the two of them realize they have a really bad situation on their hands. So as Marty begins to savagely beat and stab Sue in an effort to get rid of the intended target of their crime and eliminate witnesses, Bo goes first and kills Johnny, who is severely injured, before turning his attention to Dana, who he decides to manually strangle, possibly because he has lost his hammer at this point and the knife that he had been wielding was bent. And that then, after all of this is done, they notice Tina standing over by the other bedroom door, and that since the mother had not survived, he was going to take his reward out on her daughter. If Sheila had been home, it probably would have been her as well. And I think it's at that point that they take Tina, and the two men flee the cabin from the front door. I don't believe that Tina Sharp survived the night. I think more likely than not, Bo took her somewhere secluded up in the Caddy Resort, sexually assaulted, and then murdered her before concealing the body with the intent of returning later and getting rid of it. That the two men went back to Marty's house. Now their blood is up, they're, you know, flush with adrenaline, still a little bit of a panic. They decide that they're gonna never mention any of this to anyone. What had meant to have been a simple rape turned into a quadruple homicide. Both men almost certainly showered, and Marty ends up burning their clothing in the wood stove, if not all of it, much of it. And the next day, it's decided that Bo is going to leave the area before it's too late. However, the bodies are discovered very quickly, making his sudden disappearance extremely suspicious to law enforcement, so he decides to hold on for a few days. And then I think that the Plumas County Sheriff's Office gets involved and finds some evidence that is not put into the files. Namely, I believe that they found fingerprints at the crime scene. There's no evidence that I've seen anywhere to suggest that gloves of any sort were worn by the perpetrators. They probably found fingerprints on the knives and the gloves, and upon getting these back, the sheriff realized, oh shit, this guy's a buddy of mine. If we put him up for murder charges, he's gonna roll on my involvement with the local drug trafficking. So he tips Marty off that, hey, you and your friend might want to get the fuck out of here. We found evidence in the form of fingerprints and semen samples that are gonna link you guys to this thing. And just to make the appearance that they are giving their all as far as a thorough investigation, both Marty and Bo are checked out by the police. Bo quickly flees the area. Whether or not he took the body of Tina Sharp with him remains to be seen. I think more likely than not, though, that Marty, who stayed in the area a little bit longer, is the one that took Tina's body out to Camp 18 and disposed of it. And I also think that it's very possible that it was Marty, trying to disguise his voice, who called the sheriff's department on April 11th of 1984 to identify the body, as he had some guilt over all of this. I have no doubt that Marty informed his therapist at the VA hospital of his involvement in these crimes. However, I do believe that the deadpan demeanor that he exhibited during this counseling session was more akin to someone who has undergone a severe shock than the type of emotionless mask that you would see with a psychopath or a serial killer. Marty probably didn't realize that by law his counselor was required by law to inform law enforcement should any type of confession of this nature be made, and that after having given this confession, both Marty and Bo did their best to stay as far away from each other and Plumas County as humanly possible in the ensuing years. So that is my theory. I think that this was a rape gone way wrong, and that as a consequence of this, the two perpetrators had to take the lives of three further individuals before fleeing the area, and that due to one of the suspects being friends with the local sheriff, they were allowed to get out of the area while law enforcement, under the direction of this sheriff, or more likely than not, at the sheriff's own hand, lost key pieces of evidence. So as to keep their name from coming up in any sort of conversations that the key suspects might have with law enforcement. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this re-look at the Keddie murders. I know I enjoyed going back over it again because of how many twists and turns there are in the case, as well as the evidence trail. Until next time, stay morbid.